This is The Takeaway for Juneteenth, 2019. Warnings about the effects of climate change are becoming increasingly dire as government officials and scientists meet in Germany.
Climate change has been called the toughest problem in international relations because of the disconnect between a collective action problem and the way that the international system is divided into 195 little pieces.
The reality of what can and cannot be accomplished at global climate conferences. Also on the show, a view of the migrant crisis from inside Mexico. And the House marks Juneteenth with a hearing on reparations.
Although the present generation of whites may be innocent of what their forefathers and foremothers did, each generation passes its debts as well as its assets on to the next generation.
And we're talking about how women athletes are expected to look, and you told us who you admired for breaking the norms.
Billie Jean King, she didn't care how she looked, how she was perceived.
Let's get rolling and start with climate change. Last month was one of the hottest Mays on record. And we're talking globally here, in a time when the past 5 years are the warmest documented and projections say the Earth's temperature rise shows no signs of slowing down. Scientists with the United Nations have predicted a strong risk of climate change-related crises like severe flooding and worsening food shortages by 2040. And if you're keeping track, that's just 21 years from now. But it's been 3.5 years since diplomats from nearly 200 nations met in Paris to discuss how to avoid this nightmare scenario. Over the next 2 weeks in Bonn, Germany, many of those same representatives are meeting again. Only this time, it's to talk about how to follow through on the pledges that 195 of those countries made. And yet the climate projections since Paris haven't shown a brighter future. If anything, they've become more dire. Current estimates have temperatures rising not by 2 degrees Celsius, the high end of the Paris Agreement's goal, but by closer to 4 degrees Celsius by 2100. So the big question is, are these international climate conferences actually accomplishing anything? And if not, what else can be done? Joining me now is Paul Bodner, who played a key role in creating the Paris Agreement as Senior Director for Energy and Climate Change at the National Security Council under the Obama administration, and he's currently Managing Director at the Rocky Mountain Institute. Also with us here in studio is Alexander Kaufman, climate reporter for HuffPost. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Alex, let's start with you. Before we even get to Bonn, we've got this backdrop of what is changing environmentally. I feel like every day in the news, there's another article that comes out that says it's getting worse faster and faster. How do current climate projections compare to where they were just 3 years ago?
Well, things certainly got a lot more serious when the IPCC report came out late last year in October. It basically said that if we are going to keep warming within the 1.5 degrees Celsius scenario that we hope to keep it within, and for context, we're at about 1.1, we are going to have to basically halve global emissions over the next decade or so and begin to suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So that was a really sobering assessment that I think really jogged a lot of policymakers. Now, speeding up to just a few weeks ago, there was the report that came out of Hawaii that showed that we hit 415 parts per million CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere, which is a level unseen basically since the dawn of human evolution. So things are really becoming a lot more alarming at a faster rate than we thought.
Paul, you were directly involved in the Paris talks. When you look at what's happening today, how much progress have we made or not made since Paris?
Well, Tanzina, climate change has been called the toughest problem in international relations because of the disconnect between a collective action problem that spans the globe and the way that the international system is divided into 195 little pieces, where each of the leaders of those countries are looking after mainly their short-term interests. So it took 30 years of trial and error to get to the Paris Agreement, and I think there's good news and bad news over the last few years. The good news is that the framework that was negotiated has endured massive political headwinds, obviously in the United States, but elsewhere, and every single nation that signed up to it is still on board, the United States being the only one that has threatened to withdraw, but under the rules of the agreement cannot actually do so until, ironically, the day after the next U.S. presidential election. So that's good. We now have hopefully an enduring framework for the decades to come to help countries ratchet down their greenhouse gas emissions. The bad news is that that framework depends on nations setting targets that are ambitious and executing against those targets. And as Alex mentioned, there we're currently falling short so far. We're not heading to a 2-degree world based on the pledges that have been made. Some countries are doing well to execute the things they've already committed to. Some are not. And in the next 12 months or so, countries will be getting back together to review whether they should ratchet up what they promised to do.
Alex, what are the goals for what's happening today or in the next 2 weeks here in Bonn? What are some of the tangible outcomes that are expected from this meeting?
So this Bonn meeting is sort of one of these incremental meetings that happen in between the larger UN climate conferences, the COPs, as they're often called. And these are essentially negotiating sessions to talk about the rulemaking process for applying the goals that were agreed to at the COPs. So at this, they are still trying to suss out what some of that rulebook will look like and figure out what implementation of the goals under the Paris Agreement and how you ramp up those goals, what that would look like.
So the big question that we're trying to answer here, and I want to get to both of you, is are these talks enough given the severity of the situation? And that's just from the perspective of saying all these countries are getting together, they're flying in, which in and of itself is a carbon footprint. You know, is that enough to really move the needle? Paul?
Yeah, you know, when we first started working on this issue as an international community, we thought that the best way to deal with it was to sort of figure out how much carbon pollution should be in the atmosphere or could be in the atmosphere, find some rational way of dividing that up among nations, assigning them targets, and then punishing them if they don't meet those targets. That was the framework of the Kyoto Protocol. And it simply didn't motivate countries to do any of those things because of the way that we have, the system we have of international law. And so the Paris Agreement is a different approach, and as I said, an enduring approach, I believe, but it does require countries to set their own targets. And so what really matters now is not what's happening necessarily in the negotiating halls, but what's happening in national capitals, what companies are doing, states and regions, and so on. You know, when we negotiated the Paris Agreement, we had as an objective to end the era of multilateral climate diplomacy, meaning we wanted to move beyond the stage where the G20 was arguing at the highest levels about whether climate change was real and how to address it. We wanted to move it down into the realm of action and implementation rather than high diplomacy. So if these talks in Bonn are a little boring, that's not necessarily a bad sign. That was the intention, but the attention does need to focus elsewhere and the spotlight, and that's on individual nations.
So, Alex, wanted to get back to that question. I mean, are these talks enough, these conferences enough? Give us your sense. Or is it more important to actually see change on the ground in local municipalities, for example?
Well, of course, local change like that makes it a lot easier to scale up. You know, it's much easier to look at a framework like, for instance, you know, we're trying to figure out what the national framework for the U.S. is going to look like. And New York State just passed one of the most aggressive and ambitious carbon reduction laws in the nation. And that is a model that can potentially be scaled. So that's a promising thing. But looking at these talks more broadly, I think it's healthy to point to a peer-reviewed paper that just came out in the Oxford Journal of Environmental Law that basically looked at some of the conflict of interest issues in the UNFCCC and how, you know, a lot of fossil fuel companies, a lot of big polluters are able to influence the talks through their participation either as observers that are able to comment throughout the process or as delegates within national delegations. And that is certainly a complicating factor. It's something that for years now has been a problem for a lot of low-lying Pacific island nations that say, you know, it's not only unfair that the United States has the carbon footprint that it has historically and currently, but, you know, it also is bringing on its oil companies to participate in these talks when they are such, malevolent actors in these negotiations. And so I think this paper, you know, really identifies some of those conflict of interest issues and may be a way forward to strengthen these talks and make them more effective, at least from the perspective of countries with the most at risk.
Also, we know at the national level, the EPA is set to unveil President Trump's revision of President Obama's Clean Power Plan. Paul, what are your thoughts on that? What are you expecting to see here?
Well, I think the story of the Obama Clean Power Plan is actually an encouraging one, even though it has been abandoned by the Trump administration. As you know, the president invested a lot of political capital and his team spent a lot of energy developing what was considered the centerpiece of the domestic climate policy of that presidency, which was a regulation that would require reductions in emissions from power plants all across the country. But what's interesting about it is that the levels that we set at the time for reducing those emissions by 2030 with such a regulation are now actually on track to be met by 2020, next year, without that regulation. And that points to something really interesting and encouraging, which is that the pace of technology development and innovation in the private sector is actually sometimes outpacing the efforts of policymakers in a helpful way. And that is why it's so important to allow innovation in the private sector to drive outcomes, because it's not necessarily true that politicians and bureaucrats can do it better.
I'm wondering also that it feels like if each subsequent administration uses this as a political football, then are we actually going to make any progress here, or are we going to get past the climate tipping point? I'm wondering if either one of you is optimistic that it won't be used that way and that will actually make change.
So the unique thing about climate change is that speed matters. Every year that we delay action, we reduce the chances that we can grapple with this problem. And so we don't have time to lurch between Democratic and Republican perspectives from one administration to the next. It's all about the pace of change. And so the next 5 years, the next 10 years are not just an important window, but the most important window for taking action on climate in this country.
Alex.
I'm somewhat optimistic. I mean, I think that the lifespan for climate denialism, as it has been practiced by particularly the Republican Party in the past decade or so, is shortening pretty rapidly. I mean, if you look at the extreme weather events that we're experiencing, if you look at just the mounting scientific projections that we're seeing, it's really hard to make the argument that things aren't changing and that humans aren't impacting it. That being said, while some of the goals of the Clean Power Plan are set to be met on a much earlier timeline, thanks to innovation, thanks to state level intervention, we are also seeing an uptick in U.S. emissions, particularly methane emissions, which are coming from natural gas, which is credited with reducing a lot of those CO2 emissions because natural gas has largely supplanted coal-fired electricity generation. And that's a big concern. Natural gas is mostly methane. Methane is a potent, although shorter-lived, greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. And, there was a report that came out just yesterday that said that we're seeing thawing of permafrost in the Arctic 70 years earlier than scientists previously predicted it. And that can set off some really frightening natural cycles. So, resting on the laurels of the reductions that have been able to be met in this short time and hoping that the next administration is going to do more and hoping that the one after that won't reduce that is wishful thinking, I think.
All right. Thanks to both of you for speaking with us about this. Paul Bodner was involved in the creation of the Paris Agreement as President Obama's Senior Director for Energy and Climate Change at the National Security Council, and he's currently a Managing Director of the Rocky Mountain Institute. And Alexandra Kaufman is a climate reporter for HuffPost. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In December, Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador was inaugurated. The new president ran on a campaign championing human rights, including for migrants traveling north through Mexico.
El desarrollo de los países centroamericanos.
We are going to promote development in Central American countries and in our country. And this is how we will handle the phenomenon of migration, not through coercive methods. Migratorio.
But López Obrador's enforcement of immigration policies has not matched up with his campaign rhetoric. Earlier this month, President Trump threatened aggressive tariffs on Mexico if the country did not stop the flow of migrants moving north towards the United States. So Mexican officials met in Washington, where they agreed to ramp up their enforcement efforts. And here to tell us what those enforcement efforts look like along the Mexico-Guatemala border is Emily Green, a freelance reporter currently in the border town of Comitán, Chiapas. Emily, thank you for being back with us.
Thank you for having me.
So what are you seeing at the border, the Mexico-Guatemala border these days?
I am seeing groups of National Guard members surveilling the border, essentially. They're serving as backup to immigration officials who are stopping buses, stopping taxi-sized vans, opening doors, asking questions of anyone they suspect of not being Mexican. And if they don't have the proper paperwork, they are taking them off those buses and off those vans and sending them to detention where they will presumably be deported.
How different is what you're seeing today from what previous Mexican presidents have done in terms of the enforcement efforts at the Mexico-Guatemala border?
So since 2014, there have been fairly robust enforcement efforts at the Mexico-Guatemala border. That was thanks to something called Plan Frontera Sur, which President Obama negotiated, and that was to beef up Mexico's southern border. What is different now is the number of checkpoints and also the, I would say, militarized feel of them. You have the National Guard, you often have the Marines, the Army, the Federal Police there backing up the immigration agents. And so before you had checkpoints and you had immigration agents doing the checkpoints, but you didn't have this kind of militarized apparatus around it.
You mentioned some of these folks, some of these migrants could be put in detention at the southern Mexico border. Do we have a sense of what those detention centers look like? We hear a lot about the detention centers here at our own southern border. How do they compare?
The Associated Press just came out with a really great report about one of the major detention centers in Tapachula, Mexico, and saying that the conditions there were simply horrendous. It sounded like a detention camp. And it's very hard to know because these detention centers on the whole do not let the press in. They're extremely closely guarded. So what we know about them is basically via terrific reporting like the AP's and also what migrants tell us. And what they say is that the conditions are extremely bad, and I think would rival some of the reports we have heard about inhumane conditions at Border Patrol facilities in the U.S.
This seems to be a shift in policy from what López Obrador promised in the lead up to his presidency. What does this tell us about Mexico-U.S. relations?
It tells us that for López Obrador, Mexico-U.S. relations are incredibly important, and that despite his initial desire to welcome in migrants from all over and to give them jobs, that he is going to jeopardize that in order to save U.S.-Mexico relations. He came in as something of a leftist firebrand, but he is still a pragmatist, and to that extent, he is really showing his cards quite early that he does not want to jeopardize trade relations. And if his defense of migrants has to go out the window, then so be it.
You've also been traveling in Guatemala and Central America. Does there seem to be any sense that migration is going to slow, whether it's into the United States or into Mexico?
I don't think so, at least not in the short term. I have a story coming out shortly in Vice News featuring an interview I did with a coyote, and he said to me something really incredible, which was that we all thought Trump was going to come in and close the door to migrants, and he just let everybody in. It was so funny to hear him say that. And I think that's still the sense in Guatemala and many parts of Central America. And I was in Guatemala just a few days ago, and I would say news travels slow. So what they're still hearing there is that it's easy to get into the United States, especially if you're a parent with your young child. The news of the crackdown on the border has not percolated back to Guatemala. So I think in the short term, we're still going to see very large numbers of migrants trying to reach the U.S. And that might change if Mexico ramps up its deportation apparatus times 10, but still the news is going to take a little bit of time to percolate back to Central America.
So, Emily, we're seeing many of the migrants stuck at the U.S.-Mexico border who are living in substandard conditions at this point. Is Mexico prepared to handle the influx of migrants, whether it's economically or politically?
So I think where we're really seeing the migrants in Mexico are in the northern border cities like Juarez, Reynosa, Tijuana. And it's worth noting that places like Juarez and Tijuana have seen violence rise in exponential levels. Last year, Tijuana was one of the most violent cities in the world. And it's in places like that where migrants are now waiting. And many of them have been returned to these northern Mexican cities under the Remain in Mexico or Migrant Protection Protocols program. And that basically requires migrants to wait in Mexico while their asylum cases play out in the United States. To answer your question, I don't think Mexico is prepared. In Juarez, there are only around 1,500 shelter beds, and one official in Juarez told me he expects at least 10,000 migrants there by the summer's end. So this could be a real problem for those cities at the same time as they're seeing an explosion in violence.
Emily Green is a freelance reporter based in Mexico, currently at the Mexico-Guatemala border. Emily, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
Today is Juneteenth, a holiday celebrating the end of slavery in the United States 154 years ago. Members of Congress chose this symbolic day to hold hearings on reparations to discuss whether the U.S. government owes anything to the descendants of enslaved people. In light of that hearing, I'm joined by Nkechi Taifa, human rights attorney and a commissioner for the National African American Reparations Commission. She's been pushing for Congress to take up this bill for years. Nkechi, welcome back to the show.
I'm glad to be back, Tanzina.
So talk about, I mean, how significant is this hearing in the House today?
It is an absolute milestone. It's a monumental milestone because H.R. 40 is a bill that has been languishing in the Judiciary Committee for the past 30 years. There's a lot of buzz going on about reparations right now. So the fact that the hearing is happening right now is quite significant.
Can you tell us a little bit more? You mentioned H.R. 40. Can you tell us a little bit more about the specifics that are in H.R. 40?
Yes, H.R. 40 is a bill to study and develop reparation proposals for African Americans Act. It is not a bill that grants one red cent to anyone. It's a bill to establish a commission to study the issue and to develop the proposals to submit for passage. It follows the path of the successful reparations bill that occurred in 1988 for the Japanese Americans who were interned during World War II. That reparations package began with a commission, a study commission to develop proposals just as this one does.
Nkechi, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was asked about reparations yesterday. Here's what he had to say.
We've, you know, tried to deal with our original sin of slavery by fighting a civil war, by passing landmark civil rights legislation. We've elected an African-American president. I think we're always a work in progress in this country, but no one currently alive was responsible for that.
Nkechi, your response to Mitch McConnell's statement.
And so I would say that we all stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. Although the present generation of whites, like McConnell, arguably, may be innocent of what their forefathers and foremothers did. As a people, they're in a privileged position because of the actions of their predecessors. Each generation passes its debts as well as its assets on to the next generation. The heritage which whites enjoy in this country is what it's been called white skin privilege. They benefit from a society, a state, and economic structure which is governed by white supremacy. And for him to equate the presidency of Barack Obama as settlement for our reparations is just absolutely repugnant.
Nikiji, we also spoke with Congressman Jim Clyburn about reparations, and we'll have that segment on later. But he told me that the reparations discussions should not, and I repeat, should not focus on monetizing reparations. That's what he says. He says it really shouldn't be about writing checks to the descendants of slaves. What is your thought on that?
So I just want to say, with all due respect to the esteemed congressman from South Carolina, that cash payments have been part of every single major reparation settlement throughout history. With that said, although cash payments should remain an important and necessary component of any claim for damages, a reparation settlement can be fashioned in as many ways as necessary to equitably address the countless manifestations of injuries sustained from slavery and its vestiges. Some other forms of redress may include land, economic development, scholarships. There are many, many, many different ways that reparations can manifest. And cash payments is only one amongst countless, countless others to be considered.
Nikiji Taifa is an attorney and a commissioner of the National African Americans Reparation Commission. Nikiji, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Tanzina.
Now we turn to another voice on reparations and the hearing today on Capitol Hill, Representative James Clyburn, a South Carolina Democrat and the House Majority Whip. Clyburn joined us on the show on Monday to talk about the national political response to white supremacy since the church shooting in Charleston 4 years ago. But he stuck around after that conversation to talk to me about today's hearings in the House on reparations. And I asked him what he hoped would come out of the hearing and the national dialogue around the topic. Let's take a listen.
I would hope that this hearing will focus on reparations in its broadest term. I think that the reason we keep losing this discussion is because we will not treat reparations as I think it should be treated. As a former teacher of history, and I continue to be a student of history, we ought to look at this issue starting with the root word. Reparations come from the word repair. What should we do to repair the problems that have come out of slavery? And I think that we make the mistake of allowing these discussions to be monetized. I cringe every time I heard people talk about reparations in the terms of getting a check. How could you determine that kind of a value? And who can you determine? What about the people who are 25% black descendants of slavery, as opposed to the people who are 100%, or who is 50%? You cannot monetize this, but you can put programs and priorities in place to deal with the institutions. The HBCUs were forms of reparations. We've allowed over the years, while we're carrying out this discussion, for these HBCUs to be undercut, underfunded, and it's taking place right here in South Carolina as well. So what we need to do is talk about reparations in the broad sense and what we can do as a government to make amends. That's what reparations ought to be about. To make amends for slavery, not to monetize slavery or to determine who gets a check as a result of slavery, but how do we make amends to people of color, to descendants of slaves, and to the institutions that are in place to help us overcome the vestiges of that slavery?
There are folks that say that slavery was an economic benefit for whites and has created essentially the bedrock for what we see today as the racial wealth gap, where white Americans have 10 to 13 times the overall wealth that black Americans do. How do we not make reparations an economic conversation, Congressman?
Ma'am, I did not say we don't make it an economic conversation. It is an economic conversation. I said we should not monetize it. That's a difference. If you educate people, if you put money into these HBCUs, if you pick up my 10, 20, 30 plan that Bernie Sanders talks about a lot, mandating that at least 10% of all this money should go into these communities that have been made distressful as a result of us, of the vestiges of slavery. That's how it is an economic situation, and we ought to treat it as an economic situation. We ought to pump money into these communities, build them up, into these institutions, build them up, because you are never, ever going to win the argument. It's just like the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision. We were told in the descendant opinion of Brigsby Elliott, that separate but equal will always be an argument. So don't try to carry determine what is separate and what is equal. Let's open a frontal attack on segregation. That's how we run the Brown decision. So what I'm saying here is let's not try to monetize this. Let's open a frontal attack on this whole issue of reparations and be very broad and exclusive, and everybody who wants to go to these HBCUs will get the benefit of education. I got a pretty good one when I came through there because they were not undercutting the school, not underfunding the school as they're doing now. They're doing it while carrying out this argument, and we are losing this issue because we will not broaden the discussion of reparations.
That was Congressman James Clyburn, Democrat of South Carolina, talking about the best way to proceed with the national discussion over slavery reparations. This is The Takeaway. The WNBA season is in full swing, and the league has more recently become known for its activism and as a place where athletes feel more comfortable being out as gay. And that move toward acceptance has had an impact on how the athletes present themselves off the court. It may seem small, but the evolution of fashion in the WNBA to include more androgynous and masculine looks marks an important change from what the league used to expect from its athletes. Brittany De La Creta is a sports writer focusing on the intersection of gender and sports. Thanks for being with us, Brittany.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about pregame looks in both the NBA and the WNBA. How long have those outfits been catching public attention before Instagram, if you will?
It's definitely been longer in the NBA, where they've almost been using the hallway like a runway, and now designers are, you know, debuting clothing on the NBA athletes and boosting sales that way. In terms of the WNBA, this is a newer thing that has definitely risen with social media, and especially this year, you've seen a major uptick in that with teams dedicating specific hallways for taking these pregame photos, and some of them even making hallway murals as a backdrop for them.
You've done reporting on how there are a number of stars in the WNBA who are embracing less gender normative fashion and looks. Who are some of those athletes?
Courtney Williams with the Connecticut Sun is one. Brittany Sykes with the Atlanta Dream. Tamara Young, who's with the Las Vegas Aces, and she actually even has her own clothing line. That's just a few, but there are many, many on every team who are doing this.
And how would you describe their looks?
I would say that gender presentation is on a spectrum, and when we think of typical traditional feminine looks, it might be heels, it might be dresses, it might be, you know, frilly items. And along the spectrum are more androgynous or gender-neutral looks, and masculine of center and butch looks as well, which may include actual men's clothes or things like blazers and pants and sneakers. So it can fall really anywhere on that spectrum.
Now, how supportive has the WNBA been about those fashion choices?
Yeah, I feel like there has been this shift, particularly in more recent years, in which the WNBA has stopped trying to shoehorn its players into an image that doesn't necessarily fit who they are. And they did that for a very long time. And it's really only, I'd say, Lisa Borders, who was the president until last season. I feel like it was part of her legacy to really start to embrace the players for who they are and to let them be themselves, which really has brought a much more authentic connection, I think, between fans and players as well.
Let's talk a little bit about that history, because you've written about the fears that, or the unfounded fears, I should say, that playing sports could make women queer or more masculine. What impact did that have on women athletes in the past and what they were expected or allowed to wear?
Yeah, so this goes back to the turn of the 20th century, where they were afraid that women were too fragile to play sports or that playing sports would make them masculine. A lot of those fears were rooted in homophobia, worries that women who became too mannish would be unable to, you know, bear children, which was seen as their purpose. And we can see, you know, in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League during World War II, made famous by the movie A League of Their Own, the players were forced to wear lipstick on the field. They had to play in skirts. They attended charm school. And these requirements were to make them both attractive to the, you know, men who might be watching and as non-threatening as possible. But those policies went deeper. It wasn't just because they wanted the women to appear feminine. It really was a fear of lesbianism that led to that. There was no fraternization policies as well between teammates because of that fear. And that continued, you know, in the WNBA's early history. I think they also tried to shoehorn their players into a more palatable, what they perceived as palatable image, which was rooted in traditional femininity. You know, in 2008, they had makeup classes for rookies, and those went on for several years, and they became optional in later years, but it was something that they asked players to do. And they even had, in the early aughts, there was a campaign they called This Is Who I Am. And to watch it now is pretty cringeworthy. There's shots of, like, Sue Bird, who's one of the best players to have ever played, like, in a bathing suit while holding a basketball. So, yeah, this history goes back a really long time.
I wonder if there, you mentioned the WNBA's previous makeup tutorials for rookies. Was there anything equivalent to how male athletes were expected to look, or were they ever trained on how to cut their hair or shave or any of those other things?
You know, I don't know. I know there's some baseball teams, like the Yankees, notoriously have a no facial hair policy. That's one that comes to mind. But I don't think it's ever been as extreme as we've seen in women's sports. And, you know, there's this perception or stereotype that all female athletes are gay, which is not true, but a lot of them are. And for a long time, there has been this effort to prevent them from being perceived as, you know, who they are.
And that fear is rooted in what? In the fact that they would turn off male viewers, or the fact that advertiser, where's that fear rooted in?
A lot of things that they would turn off the men who might be watching. I think, you know, filtered through the male gaze, which particularly sports has often been, the assumption being that the audience is male and that they wouldn't want to watch women just play sports, and that maybe the attraction might be the attractiveness of the athletes to, you know, a heterosexual male viewer. I think there was fear of losing money, or, you know, a lot of times this is driven by money. Who traditionally gets the endorsements and the marketing deals? Often that has been athletes who fit these very traditional ideas of feminine beauty, who are thin and blonde and white. So I think it's rooted in a lot of things. And also that, you know, queer women have bucked the system that, you know, revolves around patriarchy. And so there's also that as well, that they are somehow eschewing what they should be and who they should be for.
Several players on the U.S. women's soccer team have started their own clothing brands that feature a lot of gender-neutral pieces. Is that starting to become more of an option for female athletes, or are a lot of female athletes still looking to partner with bigger brands like Nike, who may not be as open to gender-neutral fashion?
I think what we're seeing is athletes creating the kind of clothes that they want to wear. And if they don't think it's available from a mainstream brand, that they're going to go out and create it themselves, you know, like Tamara Young with the WNBA. And I think what we're also seeing is, you know, you mentioned these are soccer players and we're talking about the WNBA. These two leagues have the most openly gay players, the most players who are out. And it is those players who are starting to push the boundaries of presentation, and I think moving their entire sport into a more accepting direction.
We're running out of time in the segment, but I do want to get in one question here. We're talking about fashions off the court, but what about the way women's fashions are being policed when they're playing the sport? And I think the most obvious example here is Serena Williams.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, what should be at play is the comfort and what allows them to play their game the best, but unfortunately it's often been about how they look as much as how well they play. But that is starting to change, and I hope it does.
Well, we'll see if there are more cat suits on the way. Brittany De La Creta is a sports writer focusing on the intersection of gender and sports. Thank you so much, Brittany.
Thanks for having me.
And you've been telling us which athletes you admire for breaking the norms in fashion at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Hi, my vote is for Billie Jean King. She didn't care how she looked, how she was perceived, and she took on John McEnroe and kicked his butt.
My name is Luke from San Jose, California. Always been inspired by Brandi Chastain, the soccer player for celebrating in any way that any other male athlete would have done.
Hi, my name is Sharon, and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. Serena Williams is inspirational. I think she stands up for herself really well in a world controlled by men.
Hello, my name is Scott from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'd like to highlight an athlete by the name of Zuby, who is a British powerlifter and musician, who recently broke several British women's powerlifting records while identifying as a woman. Shows an admirable level of gender fluidity and is a great victory for both women's powerlifting and the transgender community.
Hi, this is Catherine calling from Brooklyn. One of my favorite female athletes is a polo player named Sue Sally Hale, who unfortunately passed away in 2003, but she did garner a New York Times obit, so you know how important she was. And she was so important because she first started playing polo disguised as a man, because in the 50s, women weren't allowed to play polo. But by the 70s, she was accepted out as a female riding horses, playing polo along with the men, and paved the way for many, many, many female polo players, including me.
Good stuff, everyone. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. We'll see you tomorrow.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.